the best time for them to learn is right now when it's going to get a little hard over the next 2 years. Yeah. I'd much rather learn in a down market than an up market, because there's guys, if you're 32 years or less age right now, you thought you'd step out in the street and the money truck hits you every year, and it just got bigger every year. Now they're going to step out in the street. They're going to look left. They're going to look right and go, well, the money truck didn't come.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of guys will get flushed out of the business over the next, 18 to 24 months, but I think that's good for the business. But learning over the next, 18 to 24 months, I think it's going to be phenomenal.
One of my favorite things to do is raise capital. Always been something I love doing. I love putting together deals. But one thing that is always tough for me is putting together the actual pitch deck, which is really important when you're raising capital. Or whether it's a corporate overview or a track record deck or investor reporting collateral, but putting together any kind of deck for guys like me has always just been tough. And so finding a company that could do it, and not only do it, but blow your mind and make some of the best pitch decks you've ever seen, was really cool. Enter Better Pitch. Better Pitch has taken the lead and is making some of the best pitch books I've ever seen. And if you think that not having a great pitch book is important when either raising capital, showing off your company, showing off your track record, showing off to investors, you're mistaken. I think your pitch book is one of the most important pieces of collateral that you could have. So I highly recommend checking out Better Pitch. They have an incredible team. They will work with you. And if you're a Fort listener and you tell them that, they will work with you on as many revisions as you need until you're 100% satisfied. So go check them out.
One of the great joys of my life has been building Fort Capital, something that I have loved for a long time. One of the best parts about it is building it with our incredibly talented team across 3 offices, Fort Worth, Dallas, and Houston, and our team abroad. We've built an incredible enterprise focused around a mission of being the best real estate operator in the world. We really believe the better that we get at operating, the better that we get in investing. We've built some incredible technology that gives us the ability to see data that others can't and operate our company as efficiently as possible and deliver better customer service to our tenants and really everybody involved. If you want to know more about our thesis, I encourage you to go to our website, fortcapitallp.com, where we talk about why we've been investing in Class B industrial real estate since 2016, hyper-focused on it. You can learn how you can help us find deals, more about our technology and how we think about it. You can see job openings. Highly encourage you to check out our newsletter or follow us on LinkedIn. And you can do all of this by going to fortcapitallp.com.
Chuck, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start back in Nebraska. I don't actually think I've met anybody from Nebraska. Mm-hmm. What's it like growing up there?
Well, I'm from a small little town. I tell people, if you look at the map of the United States and find the absolute middle of nowhere, I'm 50 miles northwest of there. So we're 4 hours from Omaha and 4 hours from Denver. So a small town, 24,000 people. Union Pacific Railroad's the biggest employer. And my dad and my grandfather owned an Anheuser-Busch beer distributorship there. And that's kind of how we ended up there. And, I didn't know anything other than when I played basketball in college with my first year at Nebraska, transferred to SMU, and I called home in the middle of October. And my mom said, it's snowing. And I looked down, I got flip-flop shorts and a t-shirt, and I'm going to the SMU pool that afternoon. And I thought to myself, I'm never going to live there again. And I never did, because it's just, it's just crazy up there.
So they served beer even in a small town in the middle of nowhere?
Oh yeah, absolutely. A lot of it. Actually, my dad's territory was like 100 square miles,
okay,
but there were only about 50,000 people in that 100 square miles. So a lot, they drove a long way to deliver 4 cases of beer, for example. They might drive 40 miles or 50 miles round trip to deliver 4 cases because, the people in the small little town needed their beer.
And then you went to Nebraska. Why'd you go to SMU?
So I went to the University of Nebraska because I was from Nebraska and had a lot of success in high school basketball there. The coach that recruited me at Nebraska became a very close friend of mine. He was 10 years older than me, and he took a job at SMU, and he said, why don't you drive down in the U-Haul with me and help me move down there? So I did, and the whole way down there, he goes, oh, you got to think about going to SMU. I said, what's it stand for? Where is it? I mean, Dallas, Texas, I mean, I've never been there. And I got down there, looked at the school. It was gorgeous, and just decided on a whim. This was in July when school was going to start, probably 45 days later, decided to transfer. And, kind of the rest is history. I haven't lived anywhere else but Dallas in the last, 40, was that 42 years?
44 what position, years. What position did you play?
Played big guard, small forward.
Is that position still around today?
Kind of, I guess. I mean, kind of just a, yeah, I'd probably be a point guard if I was to, you know, if it was in today, if okay. I could handle the ball better.
Okay. When most people think of sales, they would think of it in business, but you kind of sent a note and you said the best sales job you ever did was at spring break in college. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, and again, I say it all the time because it's really true. I went, met my wife in Fort Lauderdale at Penrod's on the beach. And she was there. She was in school in Boston at a small girls' school called LaSalle. I was at SMU. We thought we were going to get in the NIT that year. We didn't. So at the last minute, a fraternity brother of mine invited me to go to Fort Lauderdale. And she was dancing with some guy in Penrod's. And I was fairly cocky back then. And I kind of went up to her and looked at him and said, hey, you should really be dancing with me, not him. And she goes, wow, okay. So anyway, we saw each other every night after that. She came to my fraternity formal in the spring. I went out there. I was supposed to stay 3 days at her home in Virginia Beach, Virginia. I ended up staying 2 weeks and finally convinced her that she needed to transfer to SMU. And her mom was okay with that because I think she wanted to transfer to the University of Miami. She thought SMU sounded a lot better than University of Miami. So I think that's probably what really closed the deal. But so we married 39 years in September. We've been dating since St. Patrick's Day in 1982. So that was my best sales job ever. It was a good one and it's paid dividends all the way along.
I love it. All right. Let's kind of start moving in to career. So you started at Trammell.
Well, actually, my first job out of school was with Citicorp and the investment banking group. I mean, Jerry Orr, which is an old time sports reporter on Channel 8 in Dallas, interviewed me because my last year at SMU, because I had a redshirt year, I was getting my MBA. And they said some goofy thing like, well, he's not going to the NBA. He's getting his MBA. And so this guy saw it on TV and it basically hired me because he saw this interview on TV. And I worked for him for about a year. And his interesting claim to fame was he told me that he's the only person I'll ever meet in my lifetime who could outspend an unlimited expense account. And about 6 months into my tenure there, he did that and he no longer worked there. So, and all my buddies were working in commercial real estate. And I said, well, God, this looks like a pretty fun deal. They look like they're working about half as hard and making more money. So I took a job with Criswell Development Company, the people that built Fountain Place downtown. And then about after a year, there were 186 people when I started. There were 26 of us left when I left. And I went to work for Trammell Crow, and then I was there for 16 years. But I had an offer from Crow every time before I took a job, but the third time it kind of stuck and was there for a while.
All right. I want to dig in a little deeper because Crow has just put out every all-star across the country came from this genre. It's the genre of the 80s, like Crow team. What did he have and what was going on in those days that created so many all-stars?
You know, I think the biggest thing he had is he had a lot of trust in people. Yeah. Now, again, that got a little bad for him, you know, kind of when the market got really bad. But he hired really smart guys. Hmm. Not saying I'm a smart guy. I got in. But they had a bunch of Harvard MBAs, you know, Stanford MBAs, University of Chicago, Pennsylvania, all these people. And they'd give us a lot of rope. And you could either hang yourself with it or you'd go make a lot of money. And I think there was a book that came out, you know, 10 Best Places to Work in America. One was Trammell Crow. And because there's, you know, more millionaires made than not. But I think the secret sauce is he trusted people. Yeah. But I mean, you had to prove yourself. But once you had his backing, you could go and really use his balance sheet to go do a bunch of things that otherwise you couldn't have any chance of doing.
So was that the structure? It was his balance sheet for the most part?
Yeah. I mean, he was, I don't know how many thousands of partnerships that he was in and guys got him in and some were good, some were bad. A lot of them were good.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it was fun. I mean, yeah, we had a great time. It was in the kind of mid, you know, late 80s and it kind of got dicey. You know, in 1986, when I worked at Criswell, finished working at Criswell, you know, we had 186 people, ended up with 26. The market just crashed. And so when I worked to work at Crow, I was a financial analyst and there wasn't a lot to do because we weren't really buying anything. I mean, it was just, you know, trying to keep the doors on. And there'd be days when I was a leasing agent there, we would be hitting golf balls into the drywall because we really haven't anything else to do. Because when you could put a sign up on a building in Dallas in the late 80s that said, well, you can office here for free and nobody would take you up on it.
Well, let's talk about the crash for a second.
Yeah.
Was that one of those, hey, one day it was sunny and the next day it was dark? Or could you kind of see it coming?
I don't know that I could. I couldn't see it coming really because I was so young. But I think that, you know, there were guys that woke up on a Tuesday and then 6 months later, they woke up on a Tuesday and they were broke. They didn't realize it probably then, but it just happened pretty fast because the tax law changed in 86 with all of a sudden all the deductions you could get, you couldn't get now. So we were building buildings where we would borrow 120% of the cost pull that money out. And then all of a sudden those tax deductions went away and it just made the buildings worth a lot less. But we had a great time to learn. And I tell all the young guys I meet with today, the best time for them to learn is right now when it's going to get a little hard over the next 2 years. Yeah. I'd much rather learn in a down market than an up market. Because there's guys, if you're 32 years or less age right now, you thought you'd step out in the street and the money truck hit you every year and it just got bigger every year. And now they're going to step out in the street. They're going to look left, they're going to look right and go, well, the money truck didn't come. Yeah. And so I think a lot of guys will get flushed out of the business over the next, 18 to 24 months, but I think that's good for the business. But learning over the next, 18 to 24 months, I think it's going to be phenomenal.
We'll bounce in and out of history and into this market, but you just said something. So some people might be sitting here going, but Chuck, we're already 2 years into this thing. What do you mean the next 24 months?
Yeah, well, I mean, I
what are you thinking?
Well, I think it's barely starting right now.
Really?
I mean, there is... It's certainly been slow. COVID, I really thought when COVID happened, okay, this is a thing that's going to knock the market off the box. And what happened is during COVID, the industrial side went crazy. The office side got hurt for sure, but the industrial side just went nuts. The data center side is just going crazy right now and will continue to do so. But, the office stuff, I think we still got a ways to go. What's happening right now, I think because it's an election season, is that the banks aren't being forced to mark to market. The banks are actually going, well, let's work with you. We'll kick the can down the road a little bit. And I think a lot of the banks, I think everybody's really scared the banks are going to get decimated in this. And I don't believe that to be the case because in the 80s, when we borrowed 120% of the money, it's a little bit different than, the last 3-4 years, we borrowed 65% of the money, probably on the best case kind of scenario. So they've got a 65% cost building right now. That, again, I think if it's a newer, nicer office building, for example, 65% of cost, probably going to be a pretty good deal because office is still going to get used. It's still going to get built. Same thing with multifamily. The industrial side, again, I think is in Dallas in particular. I mean, for the first time in my career over 40 years, being in Dallas-Fort Worth is the best thing that ever happened to me. Normally we'd crash the plane 3 years early and everybody else was having great success and we'd be 2 years after that. But this year, this time, we got way too many people moving to Dallas, way too many companies. And it's just being a phenomenal, it's a great place to be. If I was a young guy or girl and I wanted to be in real estate, commercial real estate business, this is the only place I'd come. I wouldn't want to be on either coast. It's just phenomenal.
I agree. The 120%. So back then you'd basically just borrow your profit and everything, build it,
and put
20% in your pocket.
Yeah, and you'd put the land in it. An inflated price as well. So, I mean, you're really getting a lot of money out of these things. But there's a lot of recourse debt and things like that. And, the Crow Company got in a bit of trouble in kind of the late 80s, early 90s, because they had done this over bond, but it was guaranteed. And the famous story is that Mr. Crow went in and met with all the banks and had all the keys to all the different builds and just shoved them across the table and said, they're all yours. Which, of course, they were like, no, we don't want those.
Yeah.
And, we just did a lot of workouts. And so what I did really the first probably 5 or 6, 7 years of my career was really working out of bad, bad problems. Not problems that I created, but problems I was there and we had to clean them up. And, boy, you'd get a pretty good tongue lashing every time you went in and saw somebody and you guys did this, you guys did that. We're like, look, hey, we didn't do it. We're just here to kind of help clean out the horse stalls. I mean, we didn't make the mess in the horse stalls.
How did you clean it up?
I think it was really, it was a lot of, hard work from a management leasing perspective. And then just dealing with a lot of the problems, right? We had buildings that weren't leased. We had to figure out a way to get them leased. We had to be, Don Williams always said, we behaved our way into this market and we had to behave our way out of the market. Mm. So we caused a lot of the stuff. So it was really just, roll your sleeves up, get dirty, go back to the basics, leasing space and, getting the things filled up and then trying to create some value from that perspective. But there's a lot of guys that, just kind of cut bait and run. And, again, you can drive around. And back in the early to mid to kind of late 80s, there were all kinds of stuff that got built that had no reason to be. But I can drive you around Dallas today and point at, probably 25 different buildings. Like, that thing never should have been built. It's never leased. It never should have been leased. But you had a dentist who hired an architect or hired a contractor because money was pretty loose. And they go build a building and they didn't really have any idea what they're doing.
Do you think if Trammell was sitting here right now, Mr. Crow, and I asked you, I said, did you see it coming? You're like, I was too young in my career to really see. Do you think he saw, did people see it coming or was it, because it seems like right now you just kind of see it coming.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think they also thought that it would be a much shorter cycle than it was. And, it lasted, like I said, in Texas for kind of years. It wasn't just, hey, it's going to be 18 months and we're out of this thing. It was like, three, four, five, six years, we were really still cleaning out stalls. So I'm sure they saw it coming, but probably didn't think it was going to be as bad as it was.
Yeah.
And because again, by nature, developers are very positive. Like, hey, we're going to build this building. It's going to be the coolest building in town. I don't care if there's a 40% vacancy. Everybody's going to want to be here. Not dissimilar to what we talked about, the building that you may be moving into.
Yeah.
You know, you have two very distinct markets. You have a brand new building that's double the cost of one that's perfectly nice, but it's three or four blocks away. People like new, especially people in Texas and in Dallas and Fort Worth in particular. Well, I want something new and shiny and really cool.
Yep. One last question on that breed of guys. So when you read, I've read books that they call them super chickens, but let's just call them these type A high powered guys, girls that want to go kill it.
Yeah.
It seemed like Trammell just hired all the... Was anybody ever competing with each other? Was it kind of a dog eat dog, or did he have it to where everybody could kind of run in their own lanes without running over each other?
I would say it's much more dog eat dog than kind of everybody running in your own lane. It's like, look, when we had five or six leasing guys when I started downtown, we had 6 million feet. So we had a lot of space to lease. But I mean, I wanted to beat the next guy, right? And it was not only did I want to beat the guy by getting deals, I wanted to beat the guy by the economics that I would perform to. So, I mean, one of the big things that Harlan used to always stress to us is, hey, your guy's job is to make me a lot of money. Yeah. And after you make me a lot of money, I'm going to let you make some money. But so in order to do that, we had to do really good deals, right? So if market was $20 a foot, how can we get 21 or 22 or 23? And how do we, you know, shorten a free rent period or give them less concessions? And so it was very competitive from that perspective. And there were guys that you knew that made a lot of leases, but you knew they wouldn't advance because they were doing, if market was 20, they'd hit 20 every time, right? Yeah. Because it's easy. And I say that a lot about a lot of third party leasing companies. I mean, their only job is to convince me, the owner, to do something I shouldn't do so they can make a commission, right? I mean, so that's where I think the whole asset management thing really comes into play, right? So if you own a building, you got to be really sure that you know what's going on in the market and not just let the broker tell you what's going on. Because again, and I don't fault them, but their job's to make commissions, not to make me money. Their job's to make them money.
For sure.
But my job's to make me money and make our partners money and our investors money.
Do you think he knew that by creating that kind of culture, it wasn't a game of, it was how long can I get these guys to stay before they inevitably go out? And as we sit here today, create Bandera. I mean, you go down the list and it's just company after company. Do you think he just knew these guys are never going to be with me forever? It was kind of a churn, keep them for a decade and knowing they're going to go off into the wild.
You know, I would think probably not, because what happened is they'd bring guys in and if you're really successful, they'd say, hey, we need to go open up the Los Angeles office. Would you like to go there? Or, hey, we're opening a New Orleans office. Or, hey, we're opening a New York City office or DC office or Raleigh, or, you know, just pick any city across the country. That's where, how you, if you advance, typically what happened is we'd take great leasing guys and they'd get an opportunity to go run an office if they did really well.
Yep.
They asked me to move to LA one time. I got asked to move to Denver one time. And, you know, for me, it was just, I really loved Dallas and I thought Dallas was really a great place to be. And, you know, after 40 years, it finally turned out that this time, I think we're going to be in the best market compared to where we were, you know, the last, you know, three or four times we went through this thing.
You've been saying it for decades
now. Yeah. Eventually it's going to come true if you say it enough.
What did your job look like towards the latter years of Trammell?
So the last job I had at Crow, I kind of was in charge of all the development we did for the kind of western half of the U.S.
Okay.
So I think at the development group at that time, we had about $4 billion in process. Prior Blackwell, my business partner, ran the whole thing. I had the western half of the U.S. Tom did all of, you know, institutional kind of stuff, all of higher learning, hospitals, and he also was a big industrial developer. So yeah, it was a big job and I was flying all over the place. I'd wake up and go, wow, where am I, in Portland or in Seattle, or did I fly to San Francisco yesterday? I mean, it was a ton of travel. I have 6 million miles on American. I don't view that as a badge of honor.
Yeah.
I think that if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't do it as long as I did. But I loved what I did. I loved the Trammell Crow Company. I loved Harlan Crow for the opportunity that he gave me early on in my career. And, you know, still am very, you know, friendly with him and certainly loyal to them. And to the extent we can help them, we always want to do that. We've partnered with him on some things since we've left, but not a lot lately.
That's so awesome. One of my favorite things I've read is I can't remember the vintage. I think it's the 80s, but the letters from the partners at Crow. And I think it was reflecting on the crash of the 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And if anybody's listening to this that hasn't read it, Google it or ask somebody in the industry, but it's 40 or 50 pages of just letters.
Yeah, it goes around. Every time we have a little bit of a downturn, that thing is all over the internet and people are sending it to each other. And yeah, it is, because it came with a lot of wisdom. It was really from the school of hard knocks. Yep. If I had to do it over again, but when we were going into the down cycle, I would have done these 10 things.
Yep.
And that's from a bunch of guys from all over the country. and guys that really had a lot of hard knocks. And these are the guys, you know, again, thought they were worth $50 million and woke up one day and they were worth a negative $50 million. And it was, yeah, I think a lot of learning experience from that.
I need to go back and just read it. It's been a long time, but I remember the first time I read it, it was like Kid in a Candy Store. It was also like middle, it was like 2013, 14. So we had a ways to go. So yeah. Maybe it'd be a good time to dust it off.
Yeah.
All right. How did Bandera start coming into the picture?
Well, I mean, the biggest issue, I think, for us is the three of us had really big jobs at Crow. In fact, I would argue that I had and Pryor had and Tom had the best jobs in the commercial real estate business anywhere in the country. We had great jobs. The problem was we weren't really working on commercial real estate. You know, we were managing people who were doing what we really love to do. And so, you know, we were traveling all the time. I was on the road 3 or 4 days a week, and I had daughters at the time who were 14 and 11. I said, look, if we're going to do this, it's time to do it now. So that's the biggest impetus was really we wanted to spend more time at home, and we actually wanted to work on deals. The only deals we worked on when we were in those senior roles were the deals that were so messed up and everybody was so mad. They wanted somebody senior. They come in, they yell at me instead of yelling at the other people. Yeah. So, but it was a great learning experience, and I still have great relationships with guys I worked with all over the country. And as you said, the alumni directory for Crow is crazy. It's probably about an inch thick, and there's, you know, hundreds of companies that have been started over the years. Because again, Mr. Crow gave these guys a lot of rope. They learned a whole bunch on his nickel, and you know, obviously made him very wealthy in the process as well. But it was a great company.
All right. You've kind of been vocal in some of our discussions and just hearing around, but how you put your current partnership together, how you thought about and vetted these guys. I mean, obviously y'all had worked together, but one thing I think that as I've studied you and just learned is you were real intentional about these are the guys I'm going to not just work with, but kind of do life with.
Yeah.
How did y'all think about that?
You know, I probably didn't think about it as much as we really should have. It more just kind of happened. Yeah. But I mean, I'd worked with these guys for probably 16 years. And so they call me the junior partner. We've worked together. I've worked with them for 38 years. They've worked with the other two have worked with each other for 40 years. So I'm the junior guy at 38 years. But, you know, I think a lot of it was just being around each other, right? And seeing how people act and the worldview that we had from a Christian faith standpoint. We'd been through a lot of life together. We'd buried parents. We buried Pryor's son in 2008. I mean, those kind of things really bring you close. And, you know, I'm a big believer, and I say this all the time, if we ever have to pull our partnership agreement out and read what we need to do, we're done. Because at that point, I mean, everybody knows what's the right thing to do. And our partnership is very simple. If a dollar comes in, we split it three ways. If a dollar goes out, we split it three ways. And so hopefully we'll never pull that partnership agreement out. In fact, we did have to pull it out, I think, 5 or 6 years ago because the attorneys wanted us to put some stuff in there that we needed in. And no one even knew where the copy of the partnership was. But ultimately, we found it and, you know, did what we did. And then we threw it back in a drawer and hopefully won't pull it out again.
All right. You said a couple of things there, but we're going to talk about Bandera. But I want to take a step back. For some people, having cancer might be the worst thing that they've ever gone through. You've said that it was the greatest thing you've ever, not maybe the greatest, but one of the best things you've ever gone through.
Yeah, without question. And again, if you'd like, I'll just expand Let's on go. The story a little bit. So, you know, I'm 37 years old. We had just taken the Trammell Crow Company public in 1997 in November. In January, they send us all out to the Cooper Clinic to get these executive physicals and do the physicals. And, you know, I'm very competitive. So on the stress test, if I'm not in the top 1%, I'd die trying, all that kind of stuff. And we did that. And I sat down with the doctor afterwards and I said, his name was Ted Mitchell. I said, Ted, is there any other test you can give me? Because one of our partners' wife had just passed away from breast cancer. I was a little bit freaked out about that and said, what other tests you got? And he says, well, we have a scan upstairs. You're way too young. You're way too healthy. You shouldn't do it. And I go, I want to do it. And so I did it. And then, you know, I did the scan and 10 minutes later, we're sitting in front of a screen going through my scan and they stopped at my right kidney. And I saw one person come up from the left side, one person come up from the right side. And they're looking, they're circling things. And all of a sudden I'm not feeling really good about things. And they basically said, look, it looks like you have renal cell carcinoma. And so I went back in the next day, did the scan again with iodine, with contrast and you know, went, it lit up and said, you know, 99.9% chance you have renal cell carcinoma. So that was a big, I mean, that was a big hit for me because I was great shape. I mean, I've always prided myself in being in a lot of shape. And I really do believe that God used a group of guys, all guys that you'll know, Mike Lafitte, Mark Gibson, Jody Thornton, Scott Dennis, Tom Leiser, one of my partners, were in a Bible study that 5 years before I had my cancer incident invited me to the Bible study. I said, nah, I go to church on Sunday. I don't need that. I'm good. Thank you. So I have this cancer situation. And again, so for a week between when I got the scan and then I had an operation where they removed my right kidney and adrenal gland, I went to brain scans, bone scans. Has it spread? I'm thinking I'm going to die. You know, what happens? I got little girls, and you know, they were 8 and 5 at the time, and it was unbelievably gut wrenching. You know, for a week, and so I go and I get the surgery, and you know, they call it a surgical cure. So I was very fortunate; didn't have to get chemo, all that kind of stuff. But I've got a scar now that's about 18 inches. It goes from the left side of my body all the way around to the kind of almost to my back on the right side. So these guys invite me to this Bible study, and I'm like, okay, I'll go to the Bible study, you know, because right now I'm a little freaked out because I thought I was going to die, still think I might die, you know, because it could come back, all those kind of things. And so there's a guy named John Mazel, who's the founder of East West Ministries, led the Bible study. And through that Bible study, these guys walked me through, you know, in the Bible, how you can know for sure you're going to heaven. So it's Romans 3:23, everybody's a sinner. Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death or eternal separation from God. Romans 5:8, but God demonstrates his love for us in this, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Romans 10:9 says that if you confess with your mouth Jesus Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. And I always tell people, I like to emphasize there's a period there, not a, hey, do all these great things and you're going to get to heaven. You only get to heaven by trusting Jesus. And Ephesians 2:8-9 was the one that really grabbed me that says, for you have been saved by grace through faith, and this not from yourselves, is a gift of God, not by works, so that no man can boast. And it was through, you know, God used the Cooper Clinic to get me to the Bible study that I didn't want to go to 5 years before, to a guy named John Mazel, who was teaching this. And I will tell you, Chris, at that point, you know, my eyes were so wide open. I was like, oh my gosh, how did I miss this? How did I go to church for 37 years and not know that Jesus was the way, the truth, and the life? And so for me, it was the biggest life change ever. And so I tell people all the time is that cancer was the best thing that happened to me. And I don't wish it on anybody unless that's what it takes. Right? Because I mean, eternity is a long time. And if we're going to spend it somewhere, I want them to spend it with me and Jesus and everybody and my family in heaven. And, you know, again, it was a very trying time, but it was a great time. And you know, my mom and dad thought I was crazy, thought I'd lost my mind because I was going to quit my job. I was going to go to the ministry. My wife's going, oh my gosh, she's going to move me to Timbuktu. What's going on here? And so, but ultimately, you know, I had another conversation with John Mazel. So not only does John lead me to Christ, but John saves my job at Trammell Crow Company. He said, look, he goes, you have got a platform already. You don't need to move to Africa or Timbuktu to have a platform in the ministry. You have a platform. The question is, will you use it or not? And so kind of from that time on, over the last, you know, what is that, 26 years, I mean, what I've really tried to do is use my platform as a business guy in Dallas, a real estate guy in Dallas, I talk to, you know, between 100 and 150 young kids every year, and they come in and they want to know about the real estate business. And gosh, I'd really love to talk to Chris Powers and say, well, I've got his number, call him, email him, you know, Bill Cawley, you know, Jody Thornton, Mark Gibson, all these guys. They're always going, yeah, you quit sending me people. I mean, and what I tell them is that for every one person I send you, I've talked to five. And so for me, I get a chance to share all of my knowledge from a real estate perspective, tell guys that they should talk to, what I think they ought to go do. And then I get a chance to share Christ with them. And I'm sure there are guys that walk out of my office and go, man, that guy's crazy as all get it. I'm never going to see him again. But, you know, I mean, it's really, I think, a calling for me. It's really what I love to do. I mean, I would say probably 20-25% of my time now is spent meeting with young people, trying to, one, mentor them, two, but to give them opportunities from a work perspective. And then three, I want to make sure that they've at least heard the name of Jesus. I mean, my job is not to be a salesman for Jesus. My job is to present the truth as I know it. And I hope the Holy Spirit grabs them. And if he didn't grab them then, he'll grab them one other time. But at least they've heard it from me. And I don't want to ever get to heaven and Jesus go, hey, good job. Well, you know, good and faithful servant. But I sent you 5,000 other kids and you didn't swing, right? So we have these at-bats every day. All of us do. And the question is, are we going to swing or are we going to watch the pitch go by? And for me, I don't want to watch a pitch go by. So it's one of the favorite things I do.
And you're incredible at it. A buddy of mine often says your job is to catch them, and he's talking about fishing, or what a metaphor to fishing. You catch them and God will clean them.
Yeah.
I want to go back real quick because I share a similar kind of path of having grown up at going to church my whole life, but it was a certain group of men at a certain weak moment in my life that changed it all. So my question really is, what do you think you got from that Bible study and that group of men that 37 years ago into church didn't give you?
You know, I think it was a pretty intimate situation. You know, there were probably at most maybe 8 guys there. And John Mazel, if you've never met John, is kind of, he's the modern day Paul. I mean, I've never in my life been with John Mazel where he hasn't shared Christ with somebody ever. I mean, every restaurant, every waitress, every hostess. I mean, the guy's unbelievable. So it was that. And I had really close friends, right? These are guys who stood by me when I had cancer. These are guys I worked. Mike Lafitte was there. I worked at Trammell Crow with him. You know, Scott Dennis, we worked at Crow together. Jody Thornton and Mark Gibson, we'd done a ton of work with those guys. Tom Leiser and I went to graduate school and then worked at Crow together and had Bandera together. So I think it's just, you know, an intimate setting where guys can really speak truth to you. And then you have a guy named John Mazel, who's, you know, he's kind of like the velvet hammer. You know, I mean, everything, every opportunity he sees is an opportunity to share Jesus. And they pounded on me and it was incredible. It was like the scales fell off my eyes. I mean, I could not believe that. I go, oh my gosh, 37 years in church. And how did I not hear this? And I went back one time. I did a deal for Watermark where I go to church and I figured out I'd probably heard the gospel about 1500 times. And I think God said, hey, this guy, he's not getting it. So we're going to throw a little cancer his way. We're going to slap him upside the head. We're going to wake him up and then we're going to figure this thing out. And that's exactly what happened. And it was, like I said, it's just been a phenomenal experience, you know, ever since then. And I've had tons of time to go on, you know, mission trips with my kids and, you know, love on a lot of people. And I think that's really what the world needs a lot more of, is people loving on each other and not being afraid to talk about who Jesus is. And I think that's one of the biggest issues we have as Christians, is that we'll sit back and we'll say we're Christians, but we don't act like we're Christians. Yeah. And we'll go to church, but I mean, church ends, you know, Sunday at midnight, and then Monday morning at 6 o'clock when you get up, well, church is gone now and I'll wait till I get next Sunday, right? So at Watermark, they always say, you know, have a nice week of worship. The big W is during the week and the little W is on Sunday. Yeah. And you're getting prepared Sunday to, you know, go out on Monday and be a warrior.
Do you remember what, like, the first, I don't know if it's like big change, but you have cancer, you go into this Bible study, you're surrounded by men, you meet this, is it Jim?
John Mazel.
What was like the first big shift in your life going forward that you were like, this is here to stay, if that makes sense?
Yeah,
you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for me, it was just a big conviction to study God's word more. Go to church now and really actually, you know, listen while I'm there, right? I mean, kind of, it changed really almost everything. Hopefully I love my wife better, my kids better. I really felt like, hey, I've got to be an example for my children, right? And they've got to see me love my wife really well. So one day when my girls get married, and they are married now, when they get married, that they see how a husband's supposed to love their wife. And it changed everything. And the way I treated people, I mean, I can still be not a really great guy. I can yell at somebody, but I mean, hopefully what I'll do is once I realize that, I can turn back, call the guy back and go, hey, I shouldn't have said, I want to ask you to forgive me, and then just have a conversation that way. And I think that tells a lot of the young guys around you sometimes when they see that, I say, you just saw me chew this guy's, you know, what out. Yep. And you're going to see me call him back and ask for his forgiveness because what I did was wrong.
Yep.
And so again, it's just, I think a change, every aspect of my life changed.
Well, you've met a lot of young people. So I'll ask this one, and we're in the real estate industry, which every day the real estate industry, I feel like, gives you two paths. Most of them are do the wrong thing, or or you can skirt by, or you can. But if somebody's kind of at that position, what do you tell young people that are kind of like, look, everybody around me knows my baggage. Yeah. I'm having this life transformation. How do I move it forward without, you know, losing friends or everybody thinking, what's going on with this guy? Like, how do you talk to young people about that? Because you mentor a lot of young people.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it is you just always have to do the right thing, right? Yeah. I mean, I think that's have the main thing be the main thing. The main thing's Jesus. And what I think that would lead you to believe is you always need to do the right thing, whether people are looking or not looking. And what I tell young guys all the time is that, look, guys, you've got to figure out who Jesus is. And then you've got to, if he is who he said he is, then you need to follow him. And if not, just go crazy and, you know, spend money and be a fool. Yeah. But if he is who he said he is, then you got to really follow him. And I think following him is really kind of trying to always do the right thing. And I'll be the first guy to admit I don't always do the right thing.
Yeah.
But what happens is once somebody points out that I didn't do the right thing, or I figure out I didn't do the right thing, then I want to go back and rectify it. Because again, I think that's as big of witness as telling somebody about Jesus. Like, how did I react in a situation where I did wrong? What did I do to go back and fix it?
For sure. It's not a game of being perfect.
Yeah.
It's a game of knowing when to repent and ask for forgiveness. And that's easier said than done.
It's hard sometimes. To do sometimes, yeah. Especially if a guy's really mistreated you. And I've been in a lawsuit with a guy that had a chance to go to after the lawsuit was settled and we lost, I had the chance to go sit down with the guy and share Jesus with him. And I'll never get in another lawsuit again. That's the main thing that that taught me. But, you know, just again, you got to love on people. And I think in today's society, I mean, everybody wants to be right and they only want to be their right. Right. So you just gotta, you know, love on people, do the right thing. And it's all about Jesus at the end of the day. It's John always says it's Jesus plus nothing. We can't add anything to his glory and we can't take anything away from it. So if we focus on him, then we're all going to be okay.
I love it. All right, back to Bandera.
Okay, here we go.
So you've had a life change. You've left Trammell. You've partnered with two guys that you've been with forever. I want to start out by just asking, how do y'all figure out what you're going to work on? Because you have done lots of deals in different arenas. So let's start there. Like, how do you know what to pursue and what not to pursue?
Well, you know, being a serial deal junkie, which I think you probably could identify that a little bit, you know, so it's, I think I always tell people that the easiest person to sell is a salesman. Yep. So we're always looking at deals and everything sounds like a great deal, right? So it's really, we have a rule in our office that we won't do anything unless we have unanimity, right? So unless everybody agrees, all three of us, so two guys can be against one. If you can't convince a third guy, we're just not going to do it. Yep. So we passed on things. So I think that's a good filter, but you know, we get excited about stuff. And you know, what we knew how to do, we thought, was build buildings and buy buildings. And so we've done a lot of that. We helped start a bank called, what's TBK? It's now TFIN. When I met a young guy in Bible study and I came back to office and said, hey man, this guy's unbelievably smart. I have no idea what he's going to do, but whatever he does, we want to be involved with it. And that's been a great investment. It's Aaron Graff, who you know, who's the CEO of the bank and just a phenomenal young man. He's not so young anymore. He's in his mid-40s. I told him the other day, I said, Aaron, you realize that the age you are now was the age I was when I met you. You know, time flies.
Are you on his daily devotional?
Yes.
He is so talented. Yeah. He's put me on there for the last couple of years and it comes out every day and it's very thoughtful.
Yeah. He's one of the special dudes. He is unbelievably special. He loves Jesus. He's one of the smartest guys I've ever been around. Again, all we hired at Crow was Harvard MBAs, Stanford MBAs. And a lot of those guys thought because they had a Harvard MBA and they put it up on the wall that all of a sudden money was going to rain on them. He's humble and he's smart. Half the time I have to tell him, say, Aaron, pretend like you're talking to a sixth grader here. I mean, you're talking way over my head, but he's just a super smart guy. He's a great guy, a great family guy, and has run, you know, created a great business.
Okay, let's dig on that. I had the Triumph note. I didn't know if we'd get there, but we're here. So smart guy, met in Bible study, you trust him. I know that he kind of told me this when we did our interview. The first business plan was like working out bad loans and kind of being a real estate guy to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, hey, we're going to buy bad loans or we'll make loans. And if they go bad, we'll take them back or we'll buy CMB. So what we did when we first started out was we bought a bunch of CMBS notes. And because he was an attorney that practiced that kind of law, he didn't have any fear about foreclosing on them, taking them back, fixing up and selling them and making money. And that's how we first got started. And then literally one day he comes to Pryor and I and Carlos Sepulveda, who was the other, Carlos was the initial investor and Tom Pryor and I were the second investor. He came to us and said, you know, I think I want to buy a bank. And we're like, well, what do you know about a bank? And he said, well, my dad's owned a bank in Oklahoma for 24 years. I said, okay, well, what do you know about it? So, you know, he found this little bank in Dallas and Pryor and I and some others went around Dallas, you know, and people would look at us and they'd look at him and go, what do you know? He'd go, well, my dad runs a bank in Oklahoma. They'd look at us and go, what do you guys know? We don't know anything. We know he's really smart and he's going to figure this thing out. And I really think that our strategy on that was, it was 100% jockey bet. Yeah. He was one of the smartest, brightest, highest integrity, highest character guys we've ever met and said, this is a guy we want to be partners with. And he's proved it every step of the way.
And just as a recap, what was the first acquisition?
So we bought a bank called Equity Bank, which was interesting enough. That was, I think, five or seven guys that left Andy Beal's bank and wanted to do an Andy Beal type bank.
Okay.
And this was in 07. So they got hammered when the great financial crisis happened. And, you know, so it was under a cease and desist order. And, you know, Aaron's, I think, 29 years old, and we're going into the board of directors saying, hey, we're going to buy this thing, and who's going to run it? I am. And it was just a phenomenal deal. So we had it under contract probably for about 18 months because we had a bunch of approvals to get to.
Yeah.
And we had to raise $55 million on that deal where you had two real estate guys running around Dallas saying, hey, we're going to start a bank, and this guy's really smart, and he'll figure it out if he doesn't know what's going on. And we were very fortunate that a lot of friends of ours trusted us, invested in the bank, and then we raised the $55 and bought the bank. And then there were two people at the bank that said, hey, I'll give you a year, but I'm not gonna stay longer than that. Well, one of them retired 2 years ago, so they've been there for 17 plus years, and the other one's still there. Wow. And again, I think it's a lot of because of the culture, but these were people that really knew what they're doing. Gail Lehman and I forget the other guy's name right now. I'm drawing a blank. But yeah, Gail's still at the bank and she's phenomenal.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
From your vantage point, from your seat, if you had to describe the series of inflection points going along, because the story is remarkable, what was like the next inflection point?
Oh gosh. You know, I think it was probably taking the bank public.
Yeah.
And I can remember sitting in a conference room up in New York City, and the investment bankers were playing the game that they always play that says, hey, you know, we told you it was going to be this, but you know, the market's tough. So now we think it's going to be, you know, less than that. And because I'd been through it once before with Crow and had some other experiences, well, let's just not do it then. And so they go out and they come back, go out and come back. Well, ultimately we did what they wanted us to do. And thankfully we did, we got it public. But that was a whole nother thing. And then all of a sudden we're public. And then it's like, well, what are we going to do? And again, Aaron has a lot of vision on what he wants to do. So it was like, hey, we're going to start acquiring banks. We bought a bunch of banks in Iowa and Illinois and Kansas and some in Colorado. And we have a little bit of a presence in Dallas, but not a big presence. And again, he just, you know, he sees things 6 months or a year down the road that I think others, you know, don't really see. And now he's got the whole transportation thing working. And again, that happened because we bought a factoring company. And it's been a really fun ride being on the board. I mean, I'll tell you that the stuff that goes on in there and the things they think about is just really amazing.
It's awesome. Okay, let's go back though. So you've built and bought office buildings. You built industrial. I actually wanted to talk about the data center. Mm-hmm. You've got this massive data center going. Let's just actually spend some time on the data center. Is that the first one you've ever done?
No. So we started a company called Skybox.
And oh, so you own Skybox too?
So, well, the Skybox guys, Rob Morris and some others, started Skybox with us probably in 2014, I think.
Okay.
And we did a deal with them down in Houston that it was interesting. It took us a long time to get it leased up, but it was really successful. Our partners, I think, made 4 or 6 times their money, but it was over an extended period of time.
Yep.
And then we did a couple of with them here in Dallas, and then they wanted to go nationwide. And we're like, hey, guys, I'm going to get on an airplane to go have fun. I'm not going to get on an airplane to go look at a real estate deal.
Yep.
And so they went out on their own, and they've teamed up with Prologis a bunch, and kind of our unwritten, I don't even think it's a written rule, that we said, if you come back to Dallas and we want to continue to work with you guys. So they came back and said, hey, we really would love to do something in Dallas. And Tom Leiser is one of my oldest partners who has he's probably spent about 4 years. He took about 4 years off of building industrial to kind of study the data center market. I'm not sure at the end of the day if that was a wise move, you know, about 7 or 8 years ago. You know, I mean, I wish we'd have kind of built a lot more industrial space, but he really understands it more than anybody. And we had this opportunity that we bought 100 acres in Lancaster and have partnered up with a great financial partner. And it's going to be a really big deal. That the issue with the data centers now, it just takes so long to get them built. So we're building a $50 million substation on our site. Well, we probably won't have that thing done for 24 to 30 months.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's all about long lead items and things like that. And then when you build the data center, you're building the physical structure is easy, right? I mean, that takes you, you know, it'll probably take us 9 months to do that, but it's all the stuff that goes inside.
Yep.
You got to figure out how you get that. And yeah, they're talking, well, they got to put it on a railroad train from, you know, Pennsylvania to Dallas, and it's going to take, you know, like 9 months to get it there. Or you can break it down in smaller components and truck it. But I mean, it's crazy all the hoops you got to jump through. But I will tell you, it's really kind of like the gold rush right now. It's a land grab. It's not so much land, but megawatts. How many megawatts can all these big providers, and you know all the big names, how much can they go grab? And what we've seen is we've had 4 or 5 of the biggest, very biggest ones in the country, you know, trying to, you know, make a deal with us. And hopefully we'll make a deal with one of them sometime in the very near future. And then it's, you know, we got to sit and wait, and we got to wait for the stuff to get in and get the substation built and then get the building built. And that'll be a 150 megawatt deal. And our hope is to have another 150 megawatts on the same site. And again, we're in discussions with Encore about that and others. But I mean, you know, the city's been great, and, you know, Encore's been great. And, you know, Skybox really understands the language. I can sit in a meeting on a data center. I have no idea what they're talking about. I mean, they use, you know, acronyms and buzzwords and all this kind of stuff. Like, well, what's the per square foot cost of this thing? Can somebody answer me? You know, tell me that. And you know, they'll dumb it down for me and tell me that. But look, they don't speak that language. I mean, it is a really unique business. And when we first got in it in 2014, I mean, you know, the yields you could get were just ridiculous. You know, 15, 16, 17, 18% yield on cost. This is unlevered yield on cost.
Yeah.
And now they've kind of been pushed down, you know, they're probably less than the double digits now. Probably less than double digits now, but it was brand new back then. And, you know, this whole AI thing, I think everybody believes that it's going to take it and just make it, you know, a hockey stick up and to the right. And so again, we're out looking for more land. And there's land out there that, you know, guys one of my good friends, who I think has been on this podcast before, was fortunate enough to buy it $3 a foot that he'll probably sell at 18 to 20 bucks a foot, you know, two years later, just because the demand's gone crazy. And people, he's buying it for an industrial building. Turns out, you know, the data center truck runs him over. And if you think about it, the land cost for one of these things is nothing. They could pay $2 or they could pay $100 a foot for the land. It doesn't matter because the other costs that go into it, you know, it turns out it's $1,500 to $1,750 a foot to build one of these things.
And it's basically all proximity to the substation power.
It's all about power. Now, sometimes they want dual feed power because it's a latency issue as well. But a lot of the AI stuff doesn't really require that. It's just like, you got to have the power because the AI is just going to keep going up and up and up. So again, my hope would be that, you know, we've got the one done. Hopefully we'll get another couple of them, you know, started in the next, you know, hopefully by the end of the year, but who knows? I mean, I really, you know, last year, I think I joked with you when we met last, that, I mean, last year I played 100 rounds of golf because I figured that if any deal that I would look at and do was one that I shouldn't, because I thought the market was getting softer. So I just didn't look at any deals. And I've kind of got a little bit of the same mantra now. I mean, I think fourth quarter this year, after the election happens, I think banks will probably be forced to do some things. Again, not that I believe banks are going to get hurt, because I really don't think they're going to get hurt as bad as people think they are. There's a lot of guys who believe they have equity in their projects that don't, that are kind of what I'll call dead man walking. And they haven't realized that yet, but they will, you know, sometime in the next 12 months, they'll look and go, gosh, I bought this apartment complex for a 3.5. My debt's 8.5 and the rents can't go up fast enough and the interest rates can't go down fast enough to make me whole again. So they're going to get wiped out. I think the banks are made pretty much whole. Maybe they take a little bit of losses, but the equity guys are, you know, they're dead. They just don't know it yet.
Okay. So in the, I've asked you about deals and you've rattled off a bank and a data center company. So that's one way to do deals, is basically help stand up companies in which you kind of partner with and invest through. Are there any more? Let's get them on the table now.
There's probably some deals I don't want to talk about that probably didn't work. The only story I will tell you that, and I love telling this because it again just goes to show you that, you know, when you should stick to knowing what you're doing. So we had a friend of ours who had this golf magazine he was going to start, and I was all enthralled. We're going to be able to get on Augusta. This is going to be unbelievable. You'll play golf anywhere you want to. And so I tell people that right now in my closet, there's an $83,333,000 shirt that I got. And that's what I got out of that investment. So it was a very expensive $250,000 lesson for the three of us. But that was just one of the goofy things we do. And again, when you're deal junkies, I mean, everything sounds great. You know, when you're a salesman, it's easy to get sold. You're like, I'm in. This golf thing's going to be unbelievable. And I bet we didn't know in less than 6 months and it went under. And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
It's a nice golf shirt, but it's not that nice.
Yeah. How are y'all structured? I go to the website, very few people, but you have lots of deals.
Yeah.
So how have you thought about it? Because clearly you're clearly not managing, you're not leasing. You're probably outsourcing even more. Like, how do you think about it from, we're going to stay nimble and small and we're going to let everybody else do X?
Yeah. I mean, I think we really originally started out, I can remember that we hired an intern and we put together a business plan to kind of recreate the Trammell Crow Company. And we all three looked at each other and said, well, why are we doing that? We just had the best jobs in the industry. Why would we try to go recreate that? And I think it became pretty clear to us that we didn't want to manage, you know, hundreds and even thousands of people, which we had at Crow. And so we wanted to keep it small. And the way to do that is you outsource a bunch of stuff. So we originally bought into Stream. So we owned about, I think, 5 or 10% of Stream, which was great. So Mike and Lee both of those guys worked with us at Trammell Crow and love those guys, still do. They bought us out probably 10 years ago, because again, they were growing, they needed this stuff there. And we wanted somebody to manage and lease our property. And that was a perfect deal because again, we had this mindset of we wanted to own kind of whoever was going to do that. And so then about probably 8 or 9 years ago, my brother has a company in Austin called HPI. Mm. They wanted to come to Dallas and we said, well, gosh, we'll partner with you. So we own a piece, they own a piece. And then the young man that runs the company in Dallas, Hunter Lee, owns a piece of the deal as well. So that's who does all of our management and we really leverage them. So if we did an office building today, we'd do it with those guys. We did Ross Tower downtown. We did the buildings at Preston Center together. On the industrial side, we're currently still doing our own thing there and the data center still doing our own thing. But I can see over the next several years where we get more and more entwined with them, because I think Tom Pryor and I want to do, I don't want to go to a construction meeting every week. Right. I've done that for a long time. I just don't want to do that anymore. But I want to help those guys get a construction deal. I want to help those guys get a development deal. And I want to help them get capital and debt and all those kind of things. So almost I'm kind of thinking of it like, you know, kind of what are going to be, you know, of counsel or, you know, I don't want to be a vice chairman emeritus. You know, there's too many vice chairmen in the world, but you know, just guys that are there to help the younger guys. And I think we're going to end up officing together by the end of the year. And I think I'll get a lot of energy out of that because I love young guys. My guys, you know, I meet with a bunch of them, young guys, young girls. So I'll get a big kick out of being around that and just the energy that that provides. And hopefully we'll be able to be really helpful to them. And hopefully they won't make some of the mistakes that we made. Right. I mean, one of the things when we left Crow, the biggest thing that we all had 100% alignment on was that we're not going to sign recourse debt. And we don't. We'll sign completion guarantees, but we'll not sign recourse debt. And I can't tell you the number of guys at Crow that I said before thought they were worth $50 million. Well, they signed a bunch of notes and 6 months later, they owed $50 million, right? I mean, it just flipped on them real quickly. And we're just, I mean, I view that as that's our deal with the bank is that if things go really, really wrong, then we've got the right to give it back to you. And that's the deal we negotiated. Now, we've never had to do that. And nor do we ever want to do that. And I don't think we'll have to do that, at least not on the stuff, the existing stuff we have now. But I think you just have to prepare for Armageddon and hope it never shows up.
What would you tell somebody then? And I'm sure young people ask you this. It's easy for you to say, I'm not going to take recourse debt. You've got an established career. You've got a balance sheet. Yeah. There's a lot of people that don't have that. Would you just tell them to co-GP with somebody? Or
yeah, I'd bring a partner in. Go get somebody that'll guarantee. There's guys that'll run around and guarantee debt for guys and take a piece of the deal. I'd do that. I'd do anything not to let somebody sign a personal
lower
guarantee.
Lower leverage, whatever it takes.
I mean, I'm a big believer that if a deal's good enough, you're going to be able to get non-recourse debt. You're going to get the equity. If you can't do both of those things, you probably shouldn't be doing the deal.
Yeah.
And especially for a young guy, what I would say is, look, you just got to be dogmatic. I mean, I can't tell you the number of banks when we left Crow, we sat down with, I bet 15 or 20 banks and every single one of them, well, we're only recourse lenders. We'd say, great, well, let's have a nice lunch then. And we don't need to talk about business anymore.
Yeah.
And they'd look at us like we were crazy. And then, you know, we'd figure out a way. Two or three banks took a risk on it. Plains Capital Bank was one of the first ones when Alan White was running the bank and we made a bunch of deals with them. They were all non-recourse. So then American Bank of Texas decided to do it. American National Bank decided to do it. Guaranty Bank decided to do it. JP Morgan did non-recourse for it. So all of a sudden it kind of snowballed. And if you have that the determination to just say no, and not no, but just no, then I think people really take no for no.
Yeah.
And again, there are some banks we've just never done business with, and that's okay. I mean, they have the way, it's their money. They can do with what they want, but we're not going to get put ourselves where we could have one or two deals take down everything we've worked for so long.
Yep.
And that's the problem with the recourse debt. And people get enamored, like, oh, this is a great deal. It's going to be awesome. Well, then why can't you get recourse debt for it?
Right.
Or go get some rich guy to sign the loan for you. There's guys that'll do that, and they'll take 25 or 10 to 25% of your deal. Give it to them.
Yep.
It's worth it.
Is there anything you won't do? Any asset classes you've learned over all these years you won't participate in?
You know, I'd say the answer is probably no, because
we'd probably
do anything. You know, we haven't done a hotel before, and we haven't really done any multifamily. I wish we'd have got the multifamily business. One of my best buddies is Jeff Courtright, who runs Lincoln's Development Group, and you know, I've loved watching him be unbelievably successful over there. And again, we should have stuck our toe in the water, 15 years ago, but we didn't. So I wish we'd have done that. My brother does do some multifamily stuff. So there may be some opportunities for us to invest in that storage. He does that too. We may invest in that. Hotels, I probably would be a little bit leery of because again, you have to lease it every single night. Now, the good news is you catch the rates going up, but you also, can get shut down really quickly. COVID happened and the hotel's dead. Yep. At least during COVID on the office buildings, people had obligations they continued to pay us.
Yep. If you were going to do an office deal right now, what would it have to look like?
Well, I mean, I think you need to build a really nice office building. I think amenities are probably the most important thing and really walkable. Yep. So you need to be able to walk out of your building. You need to go to the dry cleaner, the bank. You know, like Preston Center, we've got, 20 restaurants and 27 or 37 banks. I mean, it's crazy all the amenities you have right there. So I think that's probably most important.
Yeah.
And the other thing I like about Preston Center in particular is that it's landlocked, right? There's probably maybe two sites in all of Preston Center that can get built on right now. So there's a barrier to entry. So we're leasing a building that's built in 1975. PNC is our lead tenant in there now. They're actually moving out, but we're 98% leased. We bought it in April of 20. We've raised rents probably, 12 to 15 bucks a foot over that same time frame. And again, it's 98% lease. So and they've got guys wanting to move in. So it's like a jigsaw puzzle for us now. And PNC's moving out, I think in the next, must be the next 18 months, we'll have all their, I bet you we'll have most of their space backfilled before they even move out.
How do you think about TI in today's market? I mean, that's like the one, like I talked to Bill Colley about it, is TI can run away from you.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think if you have TI today,
Yeah.
And you can make leases. I think that's a big, big bonus for you. I think you're going to make a lot more leases. You know, the TI thing, I think at the end of the day, and I don't know how this happens ultimately, but I think we need to learn to value office buildings differently. I think you need to look at the TI and you got to have it fully amortized over the term of the lease. And then the commission the same way. And that's really your net rent. Not that if you're doing $30 a foot net rent, and you give them $100 a foot on a 10-year deal, it needs to be a $20 net yield or interest rate. And that's really your yield on cost. We've fooled ourselves into believing that it really just goes to your basis. Right. But the reality is every time you do a 10-year lease with $100 a foot, when that lease comes up, they want another $50 to $100 a foot to redo it. Even if they don't want to redo it, they're still going to, the market's going to demand that you give that to them. So I think there's going to be some harder underwriting criteria. If I was a lender, if I was the equity on some of these deals, I'd really work really, really hard and look really hard at what the real yield on these office buildings are, because they're not what everybody thinks they are.
Right.
Right. So if you're buying at an 8 cap, you know, one, and if it's, you know, it's half lease building, you're really probably buying on a 6 or 5 cap because you got to put so much capital in the dang thing. And again, it's a lot of, because we got a lot of brokers running around town who are really good and they can get guys to give them concessions. But I think in this next, you know, 12 to let's say 36 months, having the ability to do tenant improvements, I think is a big deal. Our big office building downtown, we got it not refinanced. We reworked our financing on that about 6 months ago, and we've got tenant improvements and commission dollars. And I think there's going to be some buildings downtown that just don't have that. They're going to run out of gas.
Yep.
So hopefully that'll give us a chance to make some leases and then, you know, get it leased up. We're 73% now. We can get it to 85. We'll sell it and try to get everybody their money back.
Are there deals too small that you won't do? Because then again, I'm like, I was looking on your website, I'm like, this is a 6,000 foot building.
The answer is no. And, you know, where it really came up to us is really when we were offset in Preston Center, they have these little 10,000 foot lots in Preston Center where you can buy these things. We used to be able to buy them for $200 or $300 a foot to the land. And then we could lease them. We started leasing them for, like, perfect example, we built a headquarters little building for ourselves. It was 6,000 feet. It's on Sherry Lane.
That's across from the office building, right?
No, this one's down a little bit further. This is closer to Preston Road.
Okay.
And so we have this office, but it's almost done. And I get a call from a friend of mine who's a broker and said, hey, I got this tenant. They really want to have your office building. We're moving in 30 days. There's no way. And the prior's in the background going, do not lease our building out from underneath us. So finally, he kept calling me and said, look, here's the deal. If they'll pay $80 a foot triple net, then we'll do it. Which, you know, who knows what the market was, 50 at the time or something like that. So I'm thinking they're not going to do it. They come back and they hit the bid. So now I got to go tell Prior Time, hey, guess what? We're not moving to our new building. We've leased it to a bank and they took it. So, and it's just fun little deals for us, right? So we've taken a deal where we paid $1.6 million for it. We were fortunate enough to get a bank drive-through on it. All of a sudden we sold it for $6 million, right? So they're just a lot of positive leverage we had on those. And they're really hard to come by. And I think it was a really sleepy kind of market. I mean, we were pretty dogmatic about, you know, this is the price we want and this is the only price we're going to accept. And ultimately, when you got a lot of banks looking in the marketplace, I mean, people are going to compete and they're going to want to get that.
Okay. One thing we had just kind of chatted about, what's your thought on like super luxury markets? And maybe not even commercial, but residential. Yeah. We had this chat. When you look at what's happened to some of these mountain towns and some of these, there's just certain markets. Everybody listening knows what they are. But how have you seen them evolve? Like, how are you thinking about it?
You know, it's really amazing to me. When I look back in hindsight, you know, of what COVID did, and you think we went into COVID and all of a sudden second homes went doubled and tripled and sometimes quadrupled in value. It makes no logical sense to me.
Yeah.
And you would think it's got to come back or pull back a little bit, but I don't see really any evidence of it doing that. I think also during COVID, so many people made so much money because money was basically free, right? I mean, you could borrow money at 2% that I think created a lot of wealth, and people put a lot of that wealth into second homes, and a lot of guys paid cash for it. I don't think there's a lot of debt in a lot of these mountain towns and beach towns and things like that, but it makes no sense to me. It's certainly not logical. And this whole work from home thing, I mean, I'm a big believer that especially if you're young, you want to be around a bunch of people while you're working, right? Because you can't mentor a kid over Zoom. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. And so I do think people will be back in the office, but I mean, I had a friend of mine who runs a law firm, and he got a thing from the bank that said, one of your partners is trying to buy a house in Crested Butte or something like that. And he called the guy in and said, well, what are you doing? You're buying a house in Crested Butte. He goes, yeah, I'm going to move up there. I'm going to work from Crested Butte. And he goes, not at this law firm, you're not. I mean, your job's in Dallas. And I think a lot of people just took, you know, kind of got used to this and this, took advantage of the situation, said, I'm going to go buy a second home and I'm going to live up there and work. But I think that'll change a little bit. But I don't know if that means that the housing prices are going to go down. I think they just continue to go up.
I mean, you've always been kind of on the, I'll just say, again, just as this is observing in a few conversations, you're always been a little early into the next spot. If you had to say, like, how do you know? I'm not talking about Aspen. Everybody knows Aspen's good.
Yeah.
What would be something you look for in maybe a second hometown or an emerging area like that, that you'd go, this place has potential to be another thing you'd want to buy into?
You know, I think so much of it, just like we talked about on Office, but it's amenities, right? Yeah. I mean, I've got 5 grandkids now. So, I mean, everywhere we go has got to have tons of amenities, right? So the place that we go to out in Lake Tahoe has this thing called the Big Red Barn, and it's got a basketball court, a bowling alley, a soda fountain, an art studio. They've got 5 parks that are the coolest parks you've ever seen. And I think as we become grandparents, I become a grandparent, you still have young kids, but if you go and take your kids, you want to have something for them to do on campus.
Yep.
And you know, the lake deal we talked about earlier, I mean, that thing's going to have so many amenities. I mean, I can see myself going to that lake, you know, and spending a week there and maybe never getting in my car. I mean, there's times when we're in Lake Tahoe where I don't get in my car, drive a golf cart for 4 or 5 days, going, when was the last time I got in my car?
Yeah.
And I hadn't been in it in 4 or 5 days because everything's, you know, right there. So I think amenities is probably the biggest thing.
Yeah.
And then proximity to things that people love to do, like where snow ski or get on the lake or all those kind of things.
Okay. All right. I want to go back real quick.
Okay.
How do you pick partners? How do you decide if you're going to pass the hat and do it with, call it friends and family, or go to a big institution?
Yeah, for us, yeah, it's you know, I guess relatively simple. I mean, if it's probably requires a check of, let's say, $5 to $7 million or less, we do it ourselves. If it's more than that, we go to an institutional partner. And we've got great partners we've done a lot of stuff with. We go back to the same guys over and over and over again. And we haven't really done country club deals up until probably about what I call country club deals, you know, passing the hat with a bunch of friends. We did a bunch of, we did 6 retail centers and did that. That started in, I mean, I think Jack Gibbons, who was a young man that worked on the retail force, he started like the week before COVID happened. I mean, literally he and I went to lunch and like the next day they shut the world down. So that we did it that way because we'd had a lot of guys over the years saying, hey, I want to invest with you guys, do this. And so we did that. And, you know, the first 3 have worked out pretty well. The last 3, because of interest rates and things like that, I don't know how it's going to work out. I mean, it may be, it's going to be a lot harder for us to, you know, make money on those than the first 3. But it's much more institutional, I would say, or our own money than really passing the hat amongst our friends. Because again, when you have your friends, you see them every day. I mean, 1, they're going to ask about it every time. Okay. And 2, you know, you need to perform. You don't want to let anybody down.
For sure.
And I don't want to let any of my institutional partners down either. I mean, we've gotten, these guys have been good to us for the last 35 years, been friends. So, I mean, we used to like to say, you know, we'll crawl over broken glass for $5,000, right? I mean, we want these things to be successful. And it's really, you know, your reputation's really hard to get. It's really easy to lose.
Yeah.
And so you gotta have high character, integrity. You gotta do what you say you're gonna do. And sometimes you might have to, you know, put yourself in second position with your partners to be in first position. And I think, and that's why I think the 3 of us have worked out so well, because when I leave Dallas, Tom and Pryor have my checkbook. Same thing when they leave. And I know that if a bullet's coming at my back, one of them's going to jump in front of it, right? So it's that partnership is so much more than a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And I think people, you know, will come and go, oh, we're partners. And well, what does that mean to you? Well, we got a piece of paper that says this, this, and that. I mean, that's not a partnership, right? I mean, a partnership is really caring more about the other guy than you do about yourself. And if you do that, and for the 3 of us, it's worked out great. If you do that, everybody's going to really succeed. But if you have 1 guy or 2 guys that are like, hey, I'm all about me, because we've never had a year. I mean, there have been years when Tom's made a bunch of money and Pryor and I didn't really have much to do that year and vice versa. Well, he didn't sit down after he had a great year and say, well, hey, guys, you know, I made a bunch of money this year. I ought to get a little bit bigger cut. We have never done that. We, in fact, I don't think we've ever even gone back and said, well, Pryor's made this many deals and Chuck made this many deals and Tom made that many deals. And so we've never even done that because we've never thought about it like that. We're in this thing together. And what we try to do on all of our projects is everybody know enough to be dangerous. Like I can go to a meeting on a data center. Don't ask me anything other than you kind of where it is and how many megawatts it's going to be. But yeah, we can fake it enough or have enough knowledge about that to get by.
Well, to the extent you're willing to share, how does that work amongst 3? You bring a deal in. Like, how could one partner make more than the others?
Well, I mean, what I would say, so Tom, for example, we built an industrial building in Southwest Fort Worth. And
oh, I've heard.
Yeah, I mean, it was an unbelievable deal. I mean, it was just more than our wildest expectation, right? So we sold it for 30% more than we thought we would sell it for, and it was 30% leased.
Yeah.
Right. So people wanted vacant. They paid more for vacant space than they did lease space.
This was like 21, 22.
Yeah. Probably, I mean, yeah. just insane. And, you know, Tom did that deal. Tom and a guy named Marty McFarland did that deal. And, you know, prior, and I mean, I probably couldn't drive you to it right now.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was just, we bring the deal and we all talk about it and say, yeah, we agree to do it. And Tom presents a case why we should do it. And Pryor and I have thumbs up, and he goes and he executes. And like I said, we all know a little bit about what's going on, but he's the detail guy, and he's the guy that's going to carry the thing to fruition. And but it's not like, well, God, that deal made, pick a number, it made $10 million. Tom doesn't get eight because he did it.
Yeah.
You know, we split the 10
three ways.
Oh, so
you all still split it?
100%.
Oh, so when you're talking about making more money, it's whose deals made more money that year, but not who made more money.
No. Yes, exactly.
Because I was going to say that that leaves some room for like,
That
makes sense.
A dollar comes in, it split it three, and a dollar goes out. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, it's, you know, and again, there'll be years or several years ago where Tom was doing industrial, where he was just crushing it, right? But I mean, we all split it a third.
The deal y'all did, it was at Gateway?
Yeah, out by the airport.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a nice one too. Yeah. Yeah, that was great. We, you know, again, we've been very, very blessed on a lot of different fronts. And again, I think a lot of it is having great partners, both on the financial side and both the guys that sit, you know, either side of me.
Yeah.
Who are really proficient at their business. Tom's, I think, developed 70 million square feet of industrial space in the Metroplex. I mean, I don't know that there's any one person that could point to more buildings that he's had his hand on. And early on, we tried to buy industrial buildings. And the problem with that is Tom walked in and he'd find 100 things wrong with every building that he didn't build. So consequently, we just said, we got to develop them because we can't buy anything because Tom doesn't like anything.
And again, these are just questions for me because we have a bigger company now, but there's some days I wonder what it would be like to go back to having fewer people, but more third party. At any point in time at Bendera, what's the most developed? I'll start with this question. What's the most development deals you've had going on at one time?
Oh, it's probably 4 or 5.
And so are y'all engaged with architects? Like, where does your job start and end in those deals?
In those cases, you know, we basically, one of us would run point on it.
Okay.
So when we built the office center with Trevor Reese Jones in Preston Center, I mean, it was really Pryor and I both took the lead on, but we sat in every single, you know, construction meeting. We helped get the land done. We helped get the financing done. You know, Trevor was our equity. Then he decided to be a tenant as well. And then Kelsey Warren came in later and wanted to be a tenant. And so from start to finish, so cradle to grave.
Okay.
If Tom's doing like the data center, Tom will be cradle to grave with that thing.
And every partner's job is to kind of bring in deals.
Yeah, bring in deals. And, you know, I mean,
and you'll have an informal investment committee.
Yeah, the informal, it's the three of us sitting down, the investment committee, the three of us sitting down. And if we can't, if one guy doesn't want to do it, we won't do the deal.
Does that happen often?
Very rarely does
it happen.
At
this point, y'all probably would have hive mind.
Yeah, very rarely. But I mean, every now and then we'll go, that just, you know, that's kind of crazy. We don't need to do that. But I can't even think of an example of when we turned down. But again, if a guy's got conviction on it and you trust these guys, and you've done a lot of life with these guys and you've seen all the things that they've done, I mean, it's pretty compelling when a guy comes in and said, hey, we really need to do this deal and here's the reasons why. And then we go do it.
You think DFW is the best market in the country?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, almost for anything, right?
All things considered, if you left the population growth story out, which is the main, is a big driver.
Yeah.
Why else is it the best market?
Well, I mean, we're getting so many new companies moving here. You can get anywhere from Dallas. I mean, literally anywhere. Think about it. We could go to DFW right now. We could fly to Tokyo. We could fly to Singapore. We could fly to Sydney, Australia, London, you know, Paris, and any place you want to be in the world. And then when I was at Crow, when I had the western half of the U.S., I'd do day trips sometimes to everywhere but Seattle on the western side of the U.S. because it was just a little bit too far and it's hard, you know, because I'd fly in, I'd have meetings, we do that. And these guys had families. I wanted them to get home to their families and I wanted to get home to mine. So I'd fly in as early as I could, have as many meetings as I could. And then I'd get on an airplane at night and fly home and try to sleep in my own bed.
Is there any markets you wouldn't do a deal in? Are y'all only going to do DFW deals?
I think primarily we're really only going to do Texas. And that was part of the reason what we left too, because we're on airplanes all the time.
Yeah.
I think we wanted to get to the point where we could really kind of, you know, sustain ourselves being in DFW. Now, when we first started, we did some Whataburgers in Florida. We bought an office building outside of Boulder, Colorado. And I think, and then we did a few deals in Houston. But for us, we really wanted to stay local. I mean, and that's what's, you know, for the last 21 years, it's been so good to us, you know, the Metroplex. And again, I think going into this downturn, it's going to be much shorter than it's ever been in the last 40 years because there's just all the people moving in, all the companies moving in. We're very pro-business here. It's not like Houston where you have, you know, zoning all over crazy all over the place. I mean, you've got great pockets of growth. And I think the biggest issue is going to be for people moving to Dallas in particular, because that's what I know the best, is that, you know, where do you send your kids to school? Private schools are very hard to get into, which means they're going to move to the Park Cities, which means the Park Cities housing prices are going to continue to go up, even what people will consider to be a down market. Same thing with country clubs. If you move to Dallas, you can't get in a country club. And if you do, it's a 5-year wait, 7-year wait, or you got to know the very right people. So I think it's pushing some people out to Frisco because they're building campuses out there. They got great golf clubs. They got great schools out there. But again, I just think Dallas, Fort Worth, I mean, this is where I certainly want to be. And, you know, what do they think? We're going to be 10 million people sometime early in the early 30s.
Yeah.
So
do you speculate on land, not infill land? Have you bought the edges, the path of growth anywhere?
No, we never really did that. I mean, typically when we buy a piece of land, we're ready to, by the time we close on land, we want to be breaking ground.
Why?
So we try to, just because it takes all the risk out of it.
Yeah.
Now, again, we could have speculated some. So one thing we did do is we bought a 20,000 acre ranch west of Fort
Worth. I was hoping you'd bring
that.
Is this the 2008 1031 exchange?
Yes.
Okay. What happened there?
Yeah. So it was a, we had built two industrial buildings. I think it was for a company called Advo. One in Houston, one in Dallas. We had this money to 1031 in. Pryor knows a bunch about ranching and things like that. So we bought a 19,000 plus acre ranch.
Pre-crash.
And thought we were really smart, and we were gonna take the 20,000 acres and divide it up to maybe 10 smaller, you know, 1,900 acre ranches. We ran a big 16-mile water line. And again, I know nothing about ranches. So you just picture this. So we're in the car. They drive me out to Shackelford County. We're driving around and I'm going, they're just oohing and awing all over the place. And I'm going, I don't understand this. Tell me what you guys are looking at. I see some tumbleweeds and some rocks and some cows, but I don't understand the whole ranch thing. But they convinced me. So I went along with them and we bought it. And again, we bought it, maybe not at the height, but pretty close to it. And then we needed to get out of it. And we were very fortunate that we ended up selling it, a large portion of it, to Trevor Reach Jones, who was one of the most honorable guys we've ever dealt with, because he said, this is what I'll pay. And he never wavered. He could have come back and said, hey, I'm going to pay this minus 10%, 15%, 20%. I mean, we needed to sell it. And to his credit and really to our benefit, I mean, he was a man of his word and did exactly what he said he was going to do. So every time I see Trevor, I want to run up and hug him, you know, because
Trevor.
Yeah, no kidding. It was a great deal. And I think he really enjoys the ranch. Pryor kept about 4,000 acres for himself. And because I didn't get the ranch thing, I didn't understand that. And he ended up selling that, I think, right before COVID, maybe 2019 or 2020, he ended up selling that. But yeah, that was a big 1031 we had, and it turned out okay. It wasn't a great deal by any stretch, but we got our money out. We didn't lose money. And like I said, Trevor Reese Jones is a man of his word, and we'll forever go on saying that.
That's awesome. Well, I have to imagine, like, you could have bought Frisco early. You could have bought north of Frisco early. But y'all just said, we're just not playing that game.
You know, we were so much more about development that, you know, the land speculation, you know, in hindsight, I wish we would. Like, my daughter started riding horses in like 2007, 2008, and they were riding out in Argyle and Prosper and stuff like that. I wish when they started, if I'd bought 100 acres of land, I would have paid for every horse I could have ever owned, but I didn't. And so it was very expensive. But, you know, we did one deal where we bought it was a small retail center. We flipped it, and then we bought a couple pieces of land there. So that was a little bit of speculation, but we had already made a bunch of money on that. So we just 1031 into two or three different pieces of land and made good money on that. But it's in hindsight, it's probably something we should have done. We probably should have done that. We probably should have done multifamily, but we didn't. And, you know, here we are. And yeah, I don't think we'll change. I mean, our really mantra on land, unless we go through something in the next 24 months, we see something just a gigantic discount and you can buy some industrial land really cheap, or an office site that was just amazing. You know, that's how we bought the office site in Preston Center, is that, you know, Hines, who had owned the land forever, they couldn't get anything done. And we got it under contract and took it to Trevor Reese Jones. And we said, these five things. And Bill Vanderstrand was there and was very helpful. And basically said, well, let's go do this thing. And we took some risk on that because JP Morgan had a drive-through bank on the site, and we weren't getting really moving on that. And fortunately, we had a great relationship with a guy very high up at JP Morgan who helped us there. And Trevor was not afraid of JP Morgan. Yeah. And that's always a big help too, when you got a guy that's standing behind you going, yeah, go get them.
Yeah. When you own the bank. No,
yeah. Yeah. It's fun. But yeah. We just haven't been in the land. We'll speculate on land in Preston Center. So every time there's something that comes for sale in Preston Center, we try to figure out a way to buy it. And typically we set a high watermark and go, man, everybody's going to think we're crazy. But every time we've bought it, you know, the next sale is 30% more or 50% or 100% more. And I just think Preston Center, because it's such a quantifiable market that's got barriers to entry, it's a great little market for things.
Is the lesson there that an ultra, call it land type, but also call it ultra luxury markets, pricing is just, people aren't looking at every nickel and dime.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, you know, we, like I said, we leased that office, that little office building we built for sales for $80 a foot when the market was probably, if someone could argue that the market was 40 or 50, I would argue the market was 80 because it was, because it made a deal and it was really the only thing available of that kind, right? So if you build something unique in a unique market that's landlocked and you can't get in, then it's almost like you name your price. So yeah, I mean, I think that's a big lesson learned that if we could, like I said, anything in Preston Center that comes up, we try to figure out a way to buy.
Yep.
And a lot of times we shake our heads, go, man, I can't believe we just paid that much. And then it always has worked out where it's been really, really good for us. And I think there's a lot of things we tried to buy, we didn't, and wish we had them.
Yeah. Do you 1031 every time you sell?
No. Because typically we don't. We have several times, but not all the time. I mean, our deal is, you know, we typically will sell some. If we wouldn't pay what someone would pay us for it, we want to sell it. So we'll do the sell. And typically that's an environment where everything's relatively hot. So we wouldn't go buy something that we wouldn't pay for ordinarily. Now, we did exchange on a couple of the retail centers that kind of in hindsight was probably not the right thing to do. Again, we didn't know what interest rates were going to do, or we should have locked in a longer term rate. We didn't.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, if we can take a profit, we take a profit. We love capital gains. Tom hates taxes. I mean, he will do all kinds of backflips and gainers off the high dive not to pay taxes. He hates to pay taxes. So we do a lot of, always make sure we get a, you know, your capital gain in and then try to sell it and go from there.
All right. Maybe last question, maybe not. We'll see how this development. You started in the 80s, and I don't know what it took to develop a building, but from what I understand and talking to people, it was very easy to get through the city.
Yeah.
You could kind of conceptualize, put a plan together, and you're open 12 to 16 months later.
Yeah.
It seems like in the world we live in today, just to get a permit takes 12 to 16 months. And it actually seems like it's getting harder and harder, easier and easier. Yeah. Do you care? Do you think about that?
I think we think about it. I mean, and I think where it comes into play where, you know, if you have an industrial site, you feel like, hey, this is a great site. I really need to get going on this. I mean, part of the issue is the cities are really, really busy, right? With all the growth that we've had in the Metroplex. I mean, it's really hard for them to get things done.
Yeah.
And so you got to build that into the budget, right? I mean, and timing something, especially if you're building an office building, it's kind of a 2-year lead time. I mean, who knows what the market can do between now and 2 years from now.
Yeah.
So in Preston Center, we were unbelievably fortunate. A Mike Darty who built one of the buildings in Uptown. I remember, I mean, he was building, we're going, what is this guy doing? I mean, the market's dead. And then, you know, by the time it got finished, came out of the ground, I mean, he made a killing on the thing. So, yeah. You know, timing is, you know, location and timing are kind of everything, but timing is really hard to control now. And the cities have issues with just not having enough people to get things done. But, you know, you buy the right site in the right location, and I think ultimately you're going to be rewarded for it.
Well, I just kind of think just the math of, developers don't, maybe some deals get struck differently, but in hindsight or in theory, call it those 2 years of chasing and entitlements, you're not getting your development fee. Your development fee kind of starts when the shovel goes in. Yeah. Well, if the time to get to shovel took however long it took, and you actually just smooth that development fee out back to day one, you're not really making money off your development fee. You're kind of playing catch up.
Yeah,
so you either have to have lots of developments going on. If you're not a fee developer that's in the, y'all are in a different stage.
Yeah, we won't do a development for a fee. I mean, we've had people ask us to do that. We're just, that's not. But
do you charge a fee even on like 100%. Just to y'all?
Yes, 100%.
Correct.
Yeah.
But still that fee,
But
you work for free for 2 years.
Typically what happens though, we will not typically close on a piece of land until we have everything lined up. Because typically, in an ideal scenario, what we want to have is the day we close on that land is then the next day we put a shovel
on the ground.
And we've been pretty fortunate about people to allow us to tie things up long enough to do that. And if you can do that, then you know, again, you still got to work, right? I mean, the development fee gets paid later, but there's a lot of work you got to do before that and in the interim and all the way through. So you got to do it anyway. So you just got to go do it. And then you really got to hope, really, development fee was never meant to be a big profit center for people. It's really kind of how do you cover your overhead and costs. But you really want to make money on the back end. And that's why the whole development for a fee thing. I mean, again, our time is precious. So we only have so many deals we can do on an annual basis. So I want to do the deals that I know I can make a lot of money on. And I don't want to go do a development deal if we're not going to have a chance to make a real pop on it.
All right. I know you don't have a crystal ball. You talked about 18 to 24 months going forward. What do you think needs to happen for the market to start moving again?
Well, I mean, the good news is in Dallas, I think it's going to continue to move. We're going to have a pause, I think, in Dallas. But I think the banks need to work through some of the issues that they have. And I don't think they're going to be forced to do that until kind of after the election. So let's say kind of first quarter of 25, that kind of starts.
Okay.
And that'll take them a few quarters to work through that. So, people were saying, late last year, early this year, survive till 25. Well, I mean, my guess is it's probably you want to wait till 26, right? Okay. Now, I think there's going to be opportunities to buy in 25. But a lot of the new development probably won't start until really the second half of 25, maybe the first part of 26.
So you think you'll buy anything this year?
I hope so.
Are you going to be on another 100 rounds?
Well, I'm going to hopefully try to play 100 rounds of golf. Maybe the last quarter of the year, we'll really start looking at buying some stuff. We got a couple guys that my brother's hired and Hunter Lee have hired here in Dallas to look at kind of debt, buying, purchasing debt. And like I said, I just don't think the government's really pushing people hard yet, but maybe as the election gets closer, maybe they'll start going, the Democrats or the Republicans may win and that may push them one way or the other. But eventually they're going to have to, take care of this stuff. The guys that I feel bad for are the guys that are walking around town that have a bunch of equity in these deals that's gone and they don't realize it's gone yet.
Yeah.
Right. And the reality is that they wouldn't sell it for X price today. Well, 6 months from now, they die to have that price. And 6 months from then, they'd love to have the price they can get 6 months from now. Yeah. So, I think there's just going to be a lot of guys that get wiped out on deals that they really thought were great deals, but they didn't. They had the wrong debt on them. There's office buildings that are great that are 100% leased that don't cash flow right now.
Wow.
And that's a problem.
Because of debt.
Because they had debt at 3. They didn't fix it. Now it's 8.25 and they build the thing to a 7.5% yield on cost. So now they're losing, a point on everything.
And those banks probably aren't going to advance some TI and commission dollars if they get a vacancy because they're already under.
Yeah, they're already kind of underwater. So, and those will be the opportunities, I think, where you can go in and work with a bank and, you may be able to buy the note, but then they'll put a note on that note. And, that may be another way to skin the cat.
A note on a note. That's like the most American thing ever.
That's like in the 19, it's in the 80s when we borrowed 120% of cost.
We're
right?
Back, I mean, baby.
Exactly.
Chuck, thanks for today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
This
and
it's awesome.
Really excited to see what you're going to do next.
I appreciate it.
Or continue
it.
To do.
I appreciate
That'll be
it.
Fun.
I'm 37, so I'm at that same kind of, pass that you were at.
That's wake up time, yeah. Right? What are you going to do? What are you going to do with significance in your life? I mean, I think that's really the challenge for you to figure out. Is that how do you do something that makes a lasting impact on people? Certainly your family, right? Because you've got young kids. So
yeah.
you have a daughter?
I have a 7-year-old daughter, a 4-year-old daughter, and a 1-year-old son.
Right. So those daughters, I mean, your job is to protect them spiritually and physically till you walk them down the aisle. And there's going to be times if everybody's not mad at you in your house, that you're not doing your job right enough, right? Because God has put that responsibility on you, not your wife. And so you're going to have to make those tough calls. And I would tell you, make the tough calls, right? Because it's easy to go along with what the world says is okay.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder to go along with what the Bible says and how we really know what ought to happen. And those girls are precious. I mean, you wouldn't give your $400,000 Ferrari to a 16-year-old if he showed up.
Never.
Now, why would you let your daughter pick up, why would you let your daughter get picked up by a 16-year-old kid in a beat-up pickup truck to take her out? I mean, not happening.
Yeah, dude. I needed to hear that. If everybody's mad in your house, that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, then you're doing it right.
All
right.
I mean,
at that point, you go, okay, I'm okay. It's going to be okay.
They're going to be like, why are you doing this? I'm like, Chuck told me it was fine if all of y'all were mad. No, it's true.
Yeah.
It's not easy to make the right decisions sometimes.
Yeah, it's easy to go along with the flow, and that's the world we live in today, right? Everybody's truth is everybody's truth, and the reality is truth still is truth. People just don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
We gotta speak it.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Fort Podcast. Be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast platform or hop on over to YouTube to watch full video episodes if that's what you prefer. For more information, you can check out thefortpod.com.